The lower-class family unit must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centers for the occupationally orphaned children.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Between 15 and 20,000 people homeless or in overcrowded housing here in Bristol, all the politicians say it's a priority. But will Marvin Rees actually do anything? He was suspended without pay last week from the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, after somebody shared a Jewish hate post on his Facebook page. Professor Anthony Hall is one of the world's experts on Native American history and author of Earth into Property. He's Skyping, calling into us right this very second, but we can't bring him up on the desk. There's no sound, I'm afraid. We'll try and get him on the phone. Yes, he's the author of Earth into Property on the privatisation of America by the colonists in the Indian Wars, but he's also an outspoken critic of the official narrative of 9/11. He teaches students the war on terror is nothing but an excuse to undermine international law so the US can invade any country it feels like. Also, rents on a ratchet, with the housing benefit increasingly going to keep buy-to-let landlords in clover. The great housing debate. Shelter reported in April 8 million people, one payday away from eviction order. Crisis say a homelessness duty in England that exists in Wales would cost £44 million a year nationally here, but it would save £46 million in all the costs associated with helping the street homeless. Every mayor promises to sort it out. So how is Marvin Rees getting on 5 months into his term of office? If he hasn't got things moving by now, will he ever? Paul Smith, you heard in the first hour, will be back along with housing campaigner from Avonmouth, Steve Norman, and Matthew Strange from the tenants' right group Acorn. Yes, been having problems. We can't actually hear Tony Hall, apparently, even though he's Skyped in. He's been very kind enough to do that from Alberta in Canada, Martin. But this is a case, one of those typical cases, in fact, of academic freedom. He's been targeted because somebody else, believe it or not, put a hate post up on his Facebook page.
Well, it's not even clear who would have put such a hate post up on his Facebook page. Somebody that was targeting him could put the hate post up on his page and then claim that he's done nothing about it and therefore he has to be punished by the authorities of his university. Probably he is being targeted because of his controversial views, and it's fairly clear that it's the pro-Israel Zionist lobby, B'nai B'rith in this case, who are unhappy with what he's saying and are trying to get him taken off the, basically lose him his job, even though he's got tenure at the university there. And this has happened to quite a few academics who've questioned 9/11 and also, you know, been controversial from a Zionist point of view in criticising the state of Israel. The state of Israel is incredible, and its supporters are incredibly litigious and rather tricky. So in any case, as you say, it's not his post on the Facebook page which has led to him being suspended from his job. Are we responsible for what other people put up on our Facebook pages? No doubt there's going to be an appeal and a discussion about this. Well,
he's not the first person to be subjected to this sort of thing at all, is he? And there are questions, of course, over whether it's even he's responsible. I mean, he's fighting this, obviously, in Canada. I was speaking to him last night. He's saying that there are some accusations that his principal of his university has broken the law here.
Well, he may have a strong case to make to the appeal tribunal, but I think that some people are just not prepared to tolerate people with views that they don't like, and are prepared to ruin the careers of those whose political views they oppose. And that's very dangerous, because universities, in theory, are supposed to be places where controversial views, any views, can be expressed, as long as they're expressed in a responsible fashion. And you shouldn't try and silence people just because you disagree with them. And I don't think it's accidental that Anthony Hall's been picked out, because he is, in fact, a cutting-edge critic of the war on terror, and some people don't like that.
Well, I've asked him to give us a call in, just so that we could do it on the phone rather than on Skype, because for a reason it's not coming through here on the desk. Oh, we can see him, he can hear us and everything, but we can't hear him, so there's no point in putting him through. You can't hear what he's saying at all. So let's have a listen now to some of Anthony's previous comments from a talk he did a few years ago. The talk was entitled, "Is War Really a Remedy for Terror?"
As I'm coming to see it, the exposure of the lies and crimes of 9/11 cuts so deeply, they so discredit such a sweep of the ruling class, that there is something profoundly subversive and revolutionary in our movement. And I think we need to talk about after, you know, I think we've actually done it. I think the hard work has actually happened. When I go to conferences with learned professors and whatnot, when I'm with people who are opportunists, careerists, want cracks on mainstream media, want government contracts, you're not going to get that by exploring these issues of what really happened on 9/11. So we, you know, it's not a good career move to go into this area. And I was glad to see the university politics, the academic politics that Professor Stephen Jones has faced on his campus and that I face on my campus when, for instance, Jonathan Kay attacks my graduate student when he gets a small scholarship, $7,000, Joshua Blakeney, to study 9/11 skepticism, the origins of the 9/11 wars. And we're attacked in Canada by the most powerful press machinery in the country. But my administration is holding with me. And so we can do this in the curriculum. And we're developing this in the curriculum. I'm not emeritus. I'm teaching on Wednesday night. So I'm taking responsibility for this. What are the other questions? Anybody think there's another basic question that comes up when you say, well, I'm pursuing 9/11 truth?
Why?
Like you run into, well, look, there's famine, poverty, financial debacles, war, every kind of rape and pillage all over the planet. Why would you take this one issue when there's so many other important issues? Well, I think those of us who've come to the conclusion that we put our emphasis here understand, look, we're lied to all the time. We know that. We, as children, we had to figure it out very early in life. You're just lied to on the media all the time. So what's the big deal? So there's some lies involved here. I think there's a understanding among us that this particular category of lies, this complex of lies, is so audacious. It's so diabolical, it's so comprehensive, and it's not rocket science to look at Building 7 and say that's a controlled demolition. We can argue about was it nanothermite, was it this or that, but the larger picture, you know, NORAD, what is the history of Al-Qaeda, what happened at the Pentagon, why was Bush in the bunker and was Cheney in the bunker and Bush in Florida, on and on. There's not one element of the official story that really stands up. So we have come to the conclusion that we're not going to let this category of lies go past us. And I think we can give ourselves a hand. And we will stand together and we will protect each other and we will watch each other's backs. Because there is a certain danger right now, and that is such a horrible commentary on the violation of the principles of the UN Charter, that what happened here in 1945, the principles of common decency, the principles of the rule of law.
Well, I mean, it's a shame that we haven't got him live, but of course that was an audio recording of his position, and you can see that he's taking a strong and determined position about 9/11 and also other issues, the war on terror. And I'm afraid one of the reasons why senior academics don't speak out is because they know it's more than their job's worth to tell the truth. But some people have got the guts to tell the truth anyway, and he's one of them.
Well, if you remember, back a few years ago, we had a tour from Guy Fawkes 9/11, and we booked it in. This is Webster Tarpley talking about 9/11, yeah, his analysis of those attacks at Bristol University. A few days before the talk was due to happen, they said, oh, we're not allowing this lunatic to use our lecture theatre. So we had to then find somewhere. Actually, it was QEH across the road. We're fine about it. Mm. But, you know, this sort of thing is about trying to control any kind of real discussion and debate within the highest echelons here at Bristol University, as well as over in Lethbridge, of interpreting September the 11th attacks. These are elite institutions, and they seem to be controlled by the same people who are behind the war on terror.
Well, if you do a thought experiment, if 9/11 was an inside job, you can imagine that the people who carried it out are quite determined that people are not going to ask questions about it. So anybody who does ask questions about it is punished. And therefore, those who might be inclined to speak out then realise that their jobs are at risk, their mortgages are at risk, and it's you don't even need to tell people in many academic institutions what not to talk about if you want to keep your job. And occasionally, of course, somebody has to be thrown to the lions to make sure that the message is taken on board. And then, of course, they say, well, nobody's criticising us. Then there's no academic criticism. It's not there's no academic criticism, because those who do criticise are thrown overboard.
So Anthony Hall is also an expert in Native American studies, and he makes the point of the whole war on terror is like an extension of the Native American Indian wars. Do you think that's stretching a point, Martin?
Well, I mean, there's a continuity there, is there not? Underlying all of this is greedy, powerful oligarchies who are determined to control the world's resources in their own interest.
Well, he's also talking about the names of tribes and specific individuals in those Indian wars, Indian tribes, that have been co-opted by the current US military.
These helicopters might be called Black Hawk or Apache. And of course, the most famous Apache was Geronimo. And when Geronimo was the code name given to Bin Laden, or the impersonator of Bin Laden, or the faux Bin Laden, that was very significant. Prescott Bush took Geronimo's, he robbed the grave in 1918 and literally took the skull to the Skull and Bones Club. So that's that naming of Bin Laden, Geronimo, that's what I start the paper that I wrote for this presentation with. So this text here, the cover, the reality that indigenous peoples in North America who fought the expansion of the American Empire and the transcontinental expansion of the United States of America is an imperial land grab, and it was genocidal. And ironically, those who opposed and fought it, like for instance Black Hawk, who was an Indian man in the Illinois area, he has a weapon named after him, a helicopter named after him, the Apache helicopter. Of course, Geronimo was in the custody of the United States of America for much of his life, for decades, and the United States could never say, is he a domestic prisoner who broke the laws of the United States, or is he an international prisoner? Is he a prisoner of war? And so the issues that come up in Guantanamo are very old in the history of this country. And the expansionary impulse of the American Empire is very deeply rooted in the Indian Wars.
That's Professor Tony Hall, who's been suspended without pay up in Alberta, Lethbridge University. And I hope he's joining us on the phone now. Hi, Tony, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, fantastic.
I hear you perfectly. Do you hear me?
Yes, we do. Anyway, if you could just briefly tell us what's the latest with the whole your suspension. Are you going to get your job back or what?
I'm still a professor. I'm a suspended tenured professor, which seems to be an internal contradiction. And I think this reflects very significantly on the jurisdiction where my school is, University of Lethbridge is, because there is a new legislation brought in that apparently gives university presence, presidents the capacity to simply suspend a faculty member based on whatever whim that the president might have.
Well, they're, but you can understand that. They're supposed to be running the university. They're in charge. Why shouldn't they suspend you?
Well, of course, there is at universities this institution called tenure. There is a need to protect those researchers who study things and come up with conclusions from their research which may not be well received by power. For instance, you know, Galileo at one point started saying, well, Copernicus is right. Actually, the sun, you know, is the center, not the earth. And, you know, he had to eventually, he was under house arrest for the rest of his life. So this institution of tenure is, you know, it's an international institution. When you go through this process, specialists in your specific field are assembled. They may be in Botswana or, you know, South Africa or Lithuania or Japan or wherever. So it's a very international aspect of the academy, which is to say that at the highest level of the academy, it's not just a little local thing under the thumb of some politician or some schmoozer. You know, there is a 500 people have signed a petition saying that the chairman of the Board of Governors at the University of Lethbridge, Kurt E. Schlachter, should resign because he did not protect academic freedom.
But Tony, what's happened here is that you have actually done things like linked the September the 11th attacks to the Israelis. I mean, how can you possibly do that?
Well, you know, I can read. I can read Christopher Bolin. I can see the different publications and the different postings of Alan Sabrowski. You know, my colleague on False Flag Weekly News, Dr. Kevin Barrett, takes a similar position. And, of course, you know, what happened on 9/11 is contested. But to my way of thinking, the strongest interpretation is that the Israel First neocons, the Project for the New American Century, the Netanyahu government, which is Likudnik, which is very, you know, going back to, you know, bombing of the King David Hotel and is very much centered on scientific use of terrorism, that there's no question that the most compelling interpretation of who did 9/11 is Israel First neocons to demonize Muslims, to produce a new enemy. After the demise of the Soviet Union, there is the military-industrial complex, core of the political economy of the United States, without an enemy. Israeli First neocons essentially supply the enemy. They create this false flag event on 9/11. Isn't it interesting that the first announcement of what's happening comes from Ehud Barak, the former prime minister, Labor prime minister of Israel, who it just happens to be in the BBC studios and just happens to announce before even the Twin Towers fall, in that interval after they're hit by whatever they're hit by, and you know, they're going to collapse. But before that, there he is saying, we need a war on terror. Osama bin Laden is the most obvious suspect. He basically lays out the whole scenario for what we now call the global war on terror, and we have that same interpretation given by, you know, the Blair government, the Cameron government, the Harper government, the Trudeau government, people, you know, people of great scholarly merit, like Professor David Ray Griffin, like Peter Dale Scott. I would count myself among that group. I, you know, I publish on this in a peer-reviewed text, a big book called Earth into Property. I spoke on that text when I came to London in 2011, and I believe you were playing tape from my time in London. So I'm, you know, I'm a scholar. I'm 65 years old. I've, you know, published. I have a very strong publishing record. And whether Mike Mon, the president of the University of Lethbridge, who is a phys ed teacher, who's kinesiology, I mean, he's just arrived in town recently, whether he thinks it's kind of weird that I say Israel had a role in 9/11, well, my scholarly credentials are beneath that assertion, and, you know, a lot of research is beneath that assertion. And, you know, we don't know in every detail how it was done, who did it, but we know the neocons, Israel First faction, like Michael Chertoff, who was in charge of the you know, investigation on behalf of the Justice Department. He was in the crucial chair. He transformed the investigation into the crime of 9/11 into a cover-up. You know, very early on, the Steele, which is a an evidence of what it is that made those buildings come down in the very peculiar way that they came down, where they sort of burst into talcum powder and vapor. And, you know, where did the energy come from? Was it, you know, melting steel and gravity? That just is not credible. And so the evidence of the steel being carted away under Chertoff's control, and, you know, he is a Israeli U.S. dual citizen, Dov Zakheim, Richard Perl, you know, Netanyahu himself, who in 1979 organizes the Jerusalem Conference on Terrorism and sort of invents this scenario of international terrorism and starts to say this is, you know, this is the scenario that the West has to direct and control to win terrorism, how the West can win, the book that comes out of this Jerusalem Conference of 1979.
But surely, I mean, you're actually one of the only people around the world who's a professor that's saying this stuff. I mean, surely you, all the other 99% of professors can't be wrong, Tony.
Well, I mean, the other 99% of professors just kind of avoid the subject. When you really get down to who will actually defend the official story, one of them is Michael Shermer. He came and spoke at our university. And, of course, this technique of saying, well, conspiracy theorists, it's kind of a mental illness. He's showing pictures of brains. He's saying, you know, they think this and that about Mars, or this about that about Elvis, or this or that about the Holocaust, or this about 9/11, connecting all these issues. And, you know, it's really a disgrace. And so Michael Shermer, I stood up and said, you know, you are a disgrace to the academy. He actually came from Claremont University, where David Ray Griffin, who's written 10 serious books, Professor Griffin, you know, a very senior, esteemed, genuine academic. This Michael Shermer is speaking at my university like a TV professor. He's on Oprah. He's on all these TV shows. And he's invited to my university. It's really humiliating to see that. And so I said, this is not a professor, a genuine professor. I wrote to his dean. He advertised himself as adjunct professor of economics. The dean wrote back and said, I don't even know who this person is.
Well, look, Anthony, people can still follow you, can't they? Because you do some sort of internet newspaper and also the False Flag Weekly News. Whereabouts is that?
Well, False Flag Weekly News is produced by No Lies Radio. We just did this week's version of it. So for the last 2 weeks, one of the big subjects is to report from the trenches, as it were, about what's going on at the University of Lethbridge. This story is becoming international in scale. There's obviously a problem with our universities. We talk a lot about the corruption of the mainstream media and the Zionist bias in the mainstream media from, for instance, the Rupert Murdoch press. But universities are, you know, strangely kind of silent, and it's not a good career move, for instance, to address 9/11. Or
well, as you've found. But what about your internet newspaper? What's that?
Well, it's called American Herald Tribune. I'm editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, and if you go there, you'll see the perspective that I've been developing, and colleagues like Kevin Barrett and Rafiq, also known as Robert S. Lewis, have been developing. So we're creating a record of this ongoing saga of crushing the institution of tenure and trying to take universities more severely than they already are under control. In this case in Lethbridge, it's the Brené Brith, you know, part of the Anti-Defamation League of Brené Brith, a very old, rich, powerful organization. And basically this organization emanates from the government of Israel. And even in the mission statement of the Brené Brith candidate, said its mission, its purpose, is to advocate for the security of Israel.
But your president at your university, or principal or whatever, is worried that you're teaching young revolutionaries.
Well, you know, I would not talk this way in my class. I assume that you're calling me and you have some background in this and I know who you are. And, you know, I talk on Press TV about twice a week. And, you know, the Press TV out of the Islamic Republic of Iran, out of Tehran, it's an international network. But we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran is right in the sights of Israel. And, you know, Sheldon Adelson said it should be nuked and Hillary Clinton seems to agree. So, you know, there is a sort of imperative to identify what's really going on here. This building up of the imagery of Islamic terrorism. Of course, this is a big media scam. It's sometimes referred to as the Islamophobia industry. It needs to be identified. But really, this important stand that I'm able to do this at the University of Lethbridge, people have, you know, said, how can you do that? And I had an understanding with, for instance, Andy Haken, who is, you know, understands, you know, I've had a graduate student who's from London area, Joshua Blakeney, who's quite well known in some circles. My original breakthrough on 9/11 came as a result of Mohawk activists splitting the sky, sort of persuading me I have to work on this when splitting the sky attempted a citizen's arrest of George W. Bush in 2009. You know, Kevin Barrett was very much present. I worked with Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman.
Okay, Tony, can you just give us your... We're going to have to finish there. Can we just give us your websites finally, please, so people can have a look at some of your work?
Well, check this out at the American Herald Tribune. I'm going by the name Professor Tony Hall. There's a backlog of stories. We do it every week on False Flag Weekly News. The trouble here for me in Lethbridge started last summer when a journalist by the name of J.W. Schnarr wrote an article on the front page called Conspiracy Theory. If you want to see the smear on me, there's a website called Canary Mission.
I'm actually more interested in some of the things that you've said that have caused this the trouble. You know, that's, I think, much more interesting. But anyway, look, Anthony, we've got your False Flag Weekly News and your newspaper as well. Thanks very much for joining us. Finally, we managed to get round to you on the politics show here.
Anthony.
Thanks. Martin, this is all really about academic freedom, isn't it?
It is. And, of course, when people like Professor Hall, who are actually, senior academics, are booted out of their roles like this, it sends a clear message to younger people who are studying in universities about what their career prospects will be if they try and ask questions about these matters. But ultimately, of course, this kind of intimidation is not to be tolerated. We need to speak freely about things, honestly about things, and some people may not like what they hear, but that's just too bad, isn't it?
BCFM. Now, German terror suspect Jabir al-Bakr's jail death is a scandal. This is a terrorist suspect apparently killed himself in jail this week, Martin.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that people that carry out these terrorist attacks supposedly end up dead so that they can't tell any tales about who recruited them or whether they were guilty?
What amazes me more than anything else is that nobody in the mainstream press at all has suspected, well, maybe these German police are crooked and they've killed him.
Well, that's more, you know, nobody asks these questions about all sorts of things. The issues are that, as you well know, it's not just 9/11. Many of these so-called terror events have very, very suspicious backgrounds.
Well, we've also had the Deep Cut Barracks, the second of the re-inquests, with this guy who's supposed to have committed suicide by shooting himself in the chest 5 times.
As you do. And, of course, what tends to happen, of course, is that certain people can be need to be eliminated because they know too much.
Okay,
and that's
finally,
the kind of thing that happens.
Finally, on our international section here, 40 million people in a massive drill in Russia. The Russians are gearing up for potential nuclear war. 40 million people involved in this drill last week. The Germans and the Swiss are saying stuff your basements full of canned food and that sort of thing. What's happening here in Britain?
Well, we're living in a bubble where none of this is happening, although we've been told this week that we're going to get very, very upset about Syria, but we don't dare do anything about it. And, of course, we're not really confronting the fact that it's quite like the British intelligence services who helped to start the war in Syria.
There's very little talk, is there, about the offer of the Russians and the Syrians to allow all of the al-Nusra out of East Aleppo with their guns, but then they refuse to go.
Well, that's why we've not heard about it, because why wouldn't they want to go if they wanted to save? What they're doing is they're holding the civilians there as hostages and human shields. And that's exactly what the Israelis accused Hamas of doing in Gaza a few years ago, if you remember. And I don't think in actual fact that the Syrian and Russian air forces are doing anything like as devastating an attack on East Aleppo as the Israelis carried out on Gaza.
One of the people behind all this, of course, is the US Army Chief of Staff, who is Mike Miles, I believe, and he had this to say, and maybe you'd just like to comment on him before we have the clip.
Well, he's not the only one. Lots of senior US military personnel are bloviating and trying to create as much tension as possible. And that's because Obama's a lame duck president and the Pentagon are now running the policy without any supervision from the White House.
I want to be clear to those who try to oppose the United States. I want to be clear to those who wish to do us harm. I want to be clear to those around the world want to destroy our way of life and that of our allies and friends. The United States military, despite all our challenges, despite our op tempo, despite everything we've been doing, will stop you and we will beat you harder than you've ever been beaten before. Make no mistake about that. Other countries, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, went to school on us. They closely watched how we fought in 91 and 03. They studied our doctrine, our tactics, our equipment, our organization, our training, and our leadership. And in turn, they revised their own doctrines, and they are rapidly modernizing the military today to avoid our strengths in hopes of defeating us at some point in the future. Recently, a senior Russian official, Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Alexander Karamenko, he said, quote, "The established world order is undergoing a foundational shakeup with the Crimea, Ukraine, and Brexit." He went on to call for the dismantling of NATO and the European Union. And he said, quote, "Russia can now fight a conventional war in Europe and win. Russia is the only country that will remain relevant forever. Any other country is dispensable, and that includes the United States. We are endgame now," end quote. We can now, and we will remain in the future, retain the capability to rapidly deploy, and we will destroy any enemy, anywhere, anytime. Additionally, the battlefield will be highly complex, almost certainly in dense urban areas, and against an elusive, ambiguous enemy that combines terrorism and guerrilla warfare alongside conventional capabilities mixed with large civilian populations.
So that's the US Army Chief of Staff there with a pretty horrific warning for us all. Yeah, we can obliterate anybody whenever we feel like it. Sounds like almost like he's trying to take us back to the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway.
Dude, go for it.
So we're joined now by Steve Norman, by Matthew Strange from Acorn, and also by Paul Smith again. Thanks for hanging on for us, Paul. And I'd just like you to set out your stall to begin with on what you're going to be doing to build houses in this city, which the previous mayor didn't do.
Well, what we're doing is using our land to produce new housing and to lever in and to ensure that we get affordable housing. The private sector isn't delivering on affordable housing. In fact, most of the private sector is finding every excuse not to build affordable housing. So it's about getting our land out there, but not by selling it, by holding on to it until housing is built, rather than passing it over. I passed the Speedwell swimming pool site, which I think was sold 8 or 9 years ago by the council for flats, and I think I've said on this programme before, selling land to build houses on, all that allows people to do is to speculate in the land market rather than forcing them to build houses.
Well, you do wonder if some of these people aren't really just land speculators rather than developers. Anyway, Steve Norman from Avonmouth, what do you think needs to be done here?
I think that the poor one is, and the mayor have got the right ideal. I think the problem they got is, one, within the structure of the council, the officers are resistant to change. Two, I think that there needs to be more community involvement.
Well, when you say that, what do you mean exactly? People getting out, building things, getting bricks and building houses themselves?
Well,
what do you mean?
I'm not necessarily building, but I think there are enough trades within the community that can open up houses that are, you know, that are currently not in use because the system is slow. In reopening.
Well, can I ask you, how many houses have you got that are empty and properties, buildings that are derelict or disused?
Far too many. At the moment, there are almost 500 empty council properties. Now, you would expect a landlord the size of Bristol, there should be about 250, maybe 300 tops. But there are far too many of those empty. There's also empty schoolhouses, empty park houses. And, you know, one of our priorities this year is to get those opened up, because opening up existing buildings has the same effect as building new ones. But, of course, it means that you're not using up land. But I have also released land for 1,800 units so far.
Well, yeah, but you've been in for 5 months.
I know. I haven't finished them all off yet. That's
well,
terrible.
I mean, how you got started? Have you actually got started?
Yes.
In what way? Could you give us some examples?
Well, we've put three sites out to housing associations, one in Lawrence Weston, one in Coombe Dingle, one in Knoll. We've got one site in South Bristol where we're going to be building new council housing. We've got, obviously got the Hengrove Park, which has attracted a lot of attention. We've passed Astrey Close in Lawrence Weston over to Ambition Lawrence Weston. We're working with the South Mead Development Trust on making sure Dunmail happens, the school site there, but also looking at their proposals built up with the community for Glencoyne Square. So we've got lots of sites at the moment which we're putting out there and getting ready to build. Obviously, they've got to go through the planning process.
But hang on a minute, that shouldn't be too difficult. You're going to give them planning permission, aren't you?
I can't give them planning permission. I'm a developer.
But the council can.
They still have to go through. I mean, they still have to go through the same planning process that anybody else does.
Okay, Matthew Strange, tell us a bit about Acorn. What exactly is it? Because I think you represent, to quite a large extent, one of the, I suppose, people who are at the sharp end of this, that is private renting tenants quite a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, Acorn began 2 years ago in Easton with 100 volunteers and essentially started building a tenants' union to defend the rights of tenants. You know, there's some unscrupulous practices going on by landlords, by letting agents, you know, really high fees. Properties being left in a state of disrepair, and so
one of the games I've come across is this whole business of, well, you complain to your landlord that you've got rising damp, or you've got a broken window, or that your boiler isn't working, and they say, "All right, fair enough, we're going to evict you now."
Yeah, absolutely, and some landlords, say some, will use any excuse to get another tenant in that will pay that £50 more, that £100 more. Very recently, actually, there was a revenge eviction locally that was stopped by a group of Acorn members. And
so what is it, a revenge eviction?
So a revenge eviction is whereby the landlord, holding a grudge or having an issue with his tenant, attempts to remove them from the property by any means necessary, essentially because they don't like them, irrelevant of their, you know, security, the fact that they have family, children, what, you know, any of these
now,
things.
Now, I remember seeing pictures in the Bristol Post, actually, of people sort of lined all the way down the street trying to protect this person. What happened with that instance?
Well, the bailiffs came and the bailiffs left. There was enough of us there. True solidarity. It worked. It was effective. The media coverage was good. It got into the even the Daily Mail. There was a bit of misreporting from the landlord. But other than that, I think it was quite effective.
So, I mean, as an organisation, what are you actually able to achieve for people who just feel that they're paying far too much for what they're getting as a private tenant?
Well, it's pretty difficult. It's a really complex situation. Not all landlords are greedy. In fact, most of them probably aren't. There's other things that are happening, interest rates, mortgage rates, a propensity or an urge to use property and land instead of pensions. So there's massive land banking going on. And this is, you know, a question to Paul, I'd say, as well, is it doesn't matter how many affordable homes we build. How do we stop speculators buying them to then let them to the highest bidder? That is an issue of the market. Yeah. That is not anything that can be solved locally by Bristol City Council. I do commend the efforts of the new establishment to get things going and getting houses built, but I think there are some deeper issues that are related to the market.
What
we're doing is keeping ownership of the land, because a lot of the speculation comes through the land ownership, and also working with community-based organisations like South Mead Development Trust, like Ambition Lawrence Weston, like the Redcliffe Forum, like the Knoll West Media Centre, then other organisations that are coming forward, that the properties are owned collectively rather than individually. Now, obviously, we can't do that with housing that's built for sale, but with the affordable housing that we're building, we can maintain the ownership of the land after the housing is built.
You've satisfied satisfy with that, Matthew?
Not entirely. I mean,
it doesn't solve the whole problem.
No. And what is the definition of affordable? I mean, if we just take minimum wage, we had a bit of council tax on top, we had a bit of other duty and a few other things, and really...
We just put the two letters U and N in front of it, and you've got it.
Yeah.
Because it isn't affordable at all.
No, it's unaffordable.
Yeah. Well, obviously... there are some people who use the word affordable in the non-technical term, and it's unfortunately not a common sense word. But in terms of affordable, in terms of what we're looking at, it's affordable rent, which is either social rent through the council, the housing association, or some sort of community trust. And so those rents do tend to be affordable. The average council rent is £82 a week. Housing association is probably about £20 or £30 higher. And the definition is supposed to mean housing affordable to people on low incomes and benefits. And the test is, can they afford to move from full housing benefit into work without being in a financial crisis?
Well, one of the things that Steve was pointing out earlier, Paul, was that we've got a lot of people on very low incomes, or some of them either unemployed or whatever, that have got the skills to actually do places up and build them. I mean, you've got all these empty properties. Why aren't you doing something to bring people in who got the time and got the skills to do them up?
Well, we've been doing that through Bristol Together, which works mainly with ex-offenders to do up the properties that we've brought so far out of our empty property group, which previously were being auctioned off. We've been working with Bristol Together. They've been bringing in ex-offenders. They've been training them or skilling them up to take those properties on.
So have you got to go and commit an offence and get called a criminal before you can get on that scheme?
Well, you have. No. But I think there is an opportunity to have other schemes maybe targeted at young people, maybe people in colleges, to do more of that work and expand. Because obviously there's a limit to how much that organisation can do. But, you know, why would we do that with ex-offenders? Because all the evidence is, and I think the evidence from that organisation is that if you take people who've been offending and you give them skills and you give them work... and they are paid, they're not doing the work as volunteers, then they stop offending and they are no longer sort of a danger to other people. So I think that's a good thing to do. It's not the only thing that we can do. We're also working with organisations around self-build within Bristol as well. And yes, if we can galvanise more of the skills of the people of Bristol, the council not trying to do stuff but facilitate stuff, then that's all to the good.
I know one of your beefs, Steve, is that there's quite a lot of money is spent on things like hostels, maybe possibly even too much, and that a lot of the accommodation that people are being put in when they present themselves as homeless to the council is just not up to scratch.
Well, yeah. I mean, what was allowed to happen in Bristol was one particular company were able to get control of the hostel system, and this is not fit. They're flea pits. They're not fit for inhabitation.
Is that true, Paul? There's only one company that's running hostels?
Is Steve talking about the homelessness organisations, of which there are many in Bristol, which run hostels, or is he talking about the private sector ones?
The private, obviously, I didn't want to name them, but Colony and Callaghan is a classic example. Mm. I mean, you know, let me give you an example.
Basically, just to be clear, of the people who are in temporary accommodation, about 80% of them are in homes owned by Colony and Callaghan.
And that is an horrendous situation. As we've seen from the hostel in North Street, and the sewage in the basement, and the way the building was connected, it was like horrendous. You've got children in there, you've got families in there. This is where Mr. Palmer was, as you know. We took photographs of the sewage, and the response back from the officer who was in charge was, well, it's okay, it's behind the locked door. Well, just ludicrous. It's raw sewage. You know, people get typhus from stuff and crap like that.
Well, Paul, it seems pretty obvious that, potentially anyway, that something needs to be done about, first of all, not putting all your eggs in one basket, but also about checking what kind of standard accommodation. After all, us council taxpayers are paying for this.
Absolutely, and paying through the nose, it has to be said. And we're working on alternatives to using the private sector to provide housing, temporary housing. As I say, we've been refurbishing our properties and bringing them back into use. We've identified quite a few more that we can do. We're also looking, at the moment, the council is using a spot contract system where it's paying a huge amount of money per night to place people. If we can turn that into a block contract, we could probably get people to build specialist accommodation that we can use, or to buy good quality accommodation, knowing that there's a sort of long-term security around the finance. So that's absolutely something that we've got to do about. What the council is doing at the moment is not acceptable, and I'm not defending it. It's just not good enough.
How long until you change it, then?
Well, we're working on it now. We've already started changing it. More and more people are actually in council-owned accommodation rather than in private sector accommodation. But we've still got, the last figure I got, which was for a couple of nights ago, 285 families in private sector accommodation, of which about 230 were in C&C accommodation.
I think as well, we probably need to address the situation. When I first arrived in Bristol, you could get some digs, room with a sink, 150, 200 quid. Something like a hostel, but something to call your own, not supported accommodation. More houses under multiple occupation. Mm. There has to be some look at how we address that. Student accommodation is also exploitative, charging through the nose, both Bristol University, UWE, and even the private sector also charging students horrendously. Mm. We need something in the middle between hostel and having your own flat or home that just allows people to get their head down and just get on with finding a job or whatever it is they're trying to do in life.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So how are you going to do it?
Well, we're looking at procuring different types of housing now. Unfortunately, you know, anything we do that's new, as I say, has to be procured and go through the planning system. But we are starting. And the thing is although it may take some time to sort some of these things out, if you never start, you never finish either. So
I suppose that's why we're having this discussion, you know, just a few months after you've taken office. Because, you know, you've got, what is it, 4 years left to go?
Three and a half years. Yeah, I'm running out of time. I'm very impatient. I mean, I think the other point that Steve made is really important, is that we've inherited a local authority with a whole load of cultural issues about how hierarchical it is, how it doesn't empower its people enough, the way in which it sort of closes ranks whenever it does something wrong. And we're also working very hard to change that culture. We're doing that as, you know, sort of part-timers effectively coming in from the outside, but it is something that we're doing.
A couple of weeks ago I came along to your big housing conversation. What's the point of that?
Well, it's about engaging other people in the debate rather than the usual suspects. And you know, next Wednesday morning I'll be at a meeting talking to property developers, and another day I'll be talking to housing associations. And you know, it was certainly, you know, very much, you know, driven by Marvin that we should actually be doing more to speak to the consumers and the people who are being failed by the system rather than just the people who are making money out of it.
Now, what about St Mungo's? What role do they play?
St Mungo's provide a service to street homeless people, so they will go make contact with them and try and give them the appropriate advice and support.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, talking to some street homeless people, they say, well, St Mungo's come around, have a chat to us. They're then reporting back that certain people might be asylum seekers or might not have citizenship of Britain, and then they get raided by the immigration authorities. So is St Mungo's supposed to be doing that? Are you aware?
I'm not aware of, I mean, it's been said to me tonight that sometimes I'm not aware if there's any use of St Mungo's to police the homeless in that way.
I don't think
way.
They're necessarily policing, they're just informing on who's out there. So it
which
seems
is effectively
me,
policing.
This is a sort of intelligence gathering operation, it seems, as well as there to help the homeless. So why are we funding this?
We're funding them to support the homeless people, make sure that they've got proper advice and proper support.
What about the issue of tents? Because this is another thing we've come across. There's a kind of cross, as it crosses over from the Ferguson administration to the Marvin administration. I'm interested to see, I mean, are you going to be confiscating people's tents, evicting people who are in a tent because they've got nowhere to live?
Well, I mean, my view is that we shouldn't take from people their property. And if their property if their property is a tent, then we shouldn't be taking it from them. Obviously, the best place to live in Bristol is not in a tent. So what we should be doing is finding alternatives that are acceptable to those people, which are more permanent and within doors. So it's, you know, it's quite a tricky situation. Our parks are not supposed to be places where people are living,
but they will be if you fail to house people.
Yeah, and that's the problem we've got, isn't it? Is that we are in some respects failing to house people. There are also some people who actually, as a council, we haven't got a duty to house, but we've still got a duty to support them. And we've got to find what can we do within the resources that are available to the authority. Earlier on, we were talking about the people who desperately need home care that we're not providing service to. We can only put up our hand up and say, yes, we're not, because we haven't got the resources. And what we've got, you know, increasingly government gives us more and more responsibility and less money and expects us to square the circle, and it's not possible.
What about this crisis report? We reported on this show earlier this year about it. It was saying that in Wales there exists a duty to house people, including street homeless people. I think, is it something like 40 days or something? You've got to get them somewhere permanent to live. And the estimate is that that would cost £44 million. This is nationally to implement this scheme. And they're also saying, crisis, they've got an expert panel working on this over last winter, that it would cost, it would actually save £46 million because it would, all that money which is spent on helping the street homeless. So why aren't we already doing that, Paul?
Well, actually, it is the approach we're trying to take in Bristol. I mean, it's often seen that, you know, we do these counts. There's 100 people, roughly, at any one time, sleeping rough in Bristol. They're not the same 100 people that were there a month ago, very often, because people are moving through the systems that we've got. They're coming into the night shelters. They're maybe going into the hostels. They're maybe going into the guardianship schemes that we're setting up in ex-office blocks. They may be getting into permanent housing. And then more people are coming through. And there is actually a private members bill going through Parliament at the moment to have that duty within England, which we are supporting.
Private members bills never make it, though.
It's got, they? Actually, as I understand it, this one's got government support.
Wow.
And we are supporting it too. And it was raised, one of the things raised in the big housing conversation about things that we should be doing. And as I mentioned earlier on your show, we're also working through the city office to make more accommodation available to allow people to come off of the streets, particularly in the winter.
Now, Matthew's just passed a little note to me here suggesting, why don't you designate an area for people who are in tents, just as you do with travellers?
Because ultimately, we don't want people to be in tents. We want people to be indoors. And again,
the fact of the matter is, Paul, they are. What do you mean you don't want them to be?
If you're in, I know. And what we're trying to do is help them move into the mainstream housing. And, you know, if you take some of the sort of tent cities that we've had in Bristol, although there's maybe permanently been 8 or 9 people in them, they're not the same 8 or 9 people. People have been moved through that in the same way that they've moved through street homelessness. So what we don't want to do is suggest that we think the answer to the homelessness problem in Bristol is some sort of permanent tented city, because those tents, particularly as we come into winter, is not somewhere where people should live. What we've got to try and do is solve the housing problem.
Some of those people, for example, have been banned from hostels. They've got nowhere else to go but in a tent.
Well, I'm not sure that those people have been banned from all the hostels that there are. And again, that's a failure of the support services if they've been banned.
OK, well, look, we're coming up near 2:07 now, so I just want to go have a final go-round with Steve. If you were sitting in Paul's shoes and Marvin's shoes, what would you like to see most?
I'd like to see more community involvement, more organisations out there. I'm not going to mince about it. I'm not a lover of St Mungo's. I've heard the same as what you've heard. I know of one case where someone with learning difficulties, it's been failed by St Mungo's that many times. I think that there are other ways that the money could be spent than just looking to one organisation.
Paul, how much does St Mungo's get paid to look after one person? Do you know roughly? Per night?
I couldn't give you that figure off the top of my head, and I wouldn't want to make it up. I think their contract across the year is about £1 million.
Okay. Tony, I want to pick up on Connolly and Callaghan as well. You know, let's be fair, these people have got, what Paul said, 80% hold on the hostel situation. But there's something else that people don't know. Connolly and Callaghan applied for planning permission to build the new eco homes at Irmin Way in Avonmouth. Now, we're talking affordable housing. These houses are going at £250,000 a piece in Avonmouth. Show me a person in Avonmouth that's going to be able to get a mortgage on those houses.
Well, it's the old word affordable again, isn't it? Matthew, you know, if you were in
the top...
They've been down for that site.
They haven't got planning permission. Matthew, if you were in the top job, what couple of changes would you like to see?
I
I would maybe go down the route of, say, like what we've tried to do with Bristol Energy. I would set up an actual bank or a mutual building society, some type of construction company that doesn't really look for surplus, that employs locally, but apprenticeships in colleges, universities, young architects, and actually looks at a variety of different solutions. And therefore, that housing would be not owned by the state. It wouldn't be owned by the private sector. It would actually be owned by all of us. And I think this kind of quasi in the middle area is kind of where we need to be.
Paul, back in the 1930s, there were
buildings. I wasn't on the council then.
I know you were. but do we not have lessons from there? We were building council houses like they're going out of fashion, weren't we?
Yeah, yes, we were. And I mean, to no, what's this? Yesterday, I approved the council to build 200 council houses over the next 2 years.
The point
after
being,
that, we run out of money. But we are setting up Bristol bank that called the
Paul. The point being, we're in a very similar situation to the 30s with financial crisis. You know, surely it's the obvious thing to do, just build council houses.
Yes, of course it is. We are going to build as many as we can within the financial constraints we've got. So I've just approved the building of 200 over the next 2 years. But we're also building or supporting the building of community-owned.